Ved and Jurt, who will be our centre today, and Ved will speak first on the subject of NGOs in India. And please proceed, Ved.
Thank you. So basically, my presentation is based on some ethnographic work that I did last year in January in the region of Kutch. And it, just in case some people aren't really familiar, the Kutch district is in Gujarat, and my work is based on some of the resulting reconstruction of villages that happened after the earthquake in 2001. So this is just a map to familiarize you with. The epicenter of the earthquake was around Bhuj, which is in the Kutch district. So that a bit more detail of just where the earthquake took place in Gujarat, the state of Gujarat. So the earthquake that hit the Kutch district in early 2001 crippled millions of homes and destroyed the infrastructure of small villages and larger subdivisions such as Bhuj, Anjar, Rappar, and Bachau. For many, means of livelihood such as agricultural fields and livestock were taken away, resulting in states of utter dependence and desolation. Official numbers compiled after the impact showed over 18,000 lives lost, over a million homes destroyed, and $1 billion in damage incurred. Directly after the earthquake struck, indigenous NGO groups quickly mobilized to commence relief work. Realizing the integral nature of these NGOs, the state government implemented a relief scheme that would let NGOs adopt certain villages to rebuild and nurture. This dependence on NGOs led to varying results. Some villages were left in an immaculate condition that was far better than how the villages were before the earthquake. Others, however, were poorly constructed and incompatible with the needs of inhabitants, and because of this, they were afterwards deserted. What drew the attention of scholars, however, was not the quality of reconstruction, but the intentions behind this reconstruction. A number of scholars accused NGOs of pushing a Hindu nationalist agenda onto those receiving aid. More specifically, scholars claim that Hindu NGOs were constructing towns that favored Hindus and marginalized Muslims in terms of geospatial mapping and allotted resources. Hence, Muslim families were being placed on the outskirts of reconstructed towns in poorly built homes that did not meet the state government's earthquake-resistant housing requirements. Here, one town that has received extensive scholarly attention in this manner, Jiapur, which is about an hour from Bhuj, will be looked at in detail. It will be shown that scholarly accusations directed at BAPS, which stands for Bocha Sonwasi Akshar Purushottam Swaminarayan Sanstha, and is a subsect of the larger Swaminarayan movement, and for transparency, it is a movement that I am part of, are largely based on incomplete or superficial understandings of the rebuilding process that occurred in Jiapur. Scholars have failed to consider existing cultural, social, and religious dynamics that were present in Jiapur prior to the earthquake and that weighed heavily upon the construction of the new neighboring village known as Narayan Nagar that was built by BAPS. This linkage between BAPS and Hindutva, I contend, is also strongly influenced by an academic fixation on Hindu nationalism that, in lieu of recent political events, will likely grow. So this is at the gate of Narayan Nagar. So Jiapur was a previous village that underwent a lot of damage during the earthquake, and Narayan Nagar is actually right next to it, and this is on the gate of Narayan Nagar. So I arrived in Jiapur, fittingly, on January 26, 2013, exactly 12 years to the day after the earthquake in Kutch had occurred. Many parts of the original town remained in tatters, a visceral reminder of just how devastating the earthquake in 2001 had been. Just to the left of the main gate of Jiapur is the gate of Narayan Nagar, which is what this picture is of. The reconstructed village built and sponsored by BAPS from 2001 to 2004. Strikingly contrasted to Jiapur, and this is a map of the entire village of Narayan Nagar, just to show you geospatial mapping of it. These are, I guess, each and every one of the houses. This basically just says Sri Hari Nivas, which literally translates to the house of God. And it tells you the name of the inhabitants in that house and its number. This is number 62. So strikingly contrasted to Jaipur, the homes in Narayanagarh are uniform, large, and have modern architectural feel to them. So they're quite uniform, all the houses together after the reconstructed. If you look at many of the reconstructed villages, the houses are uniform in this manner. Several homes have been expanded to resemble large bungalows in major Indian cities such as Ahmedabad or Gandhinagar. And so these are the normal houses. These are extended houses that I saw at Narayanagar while I was there, which resemble actually my house in Ahmedabad, a major city. And so these are some of the homes that I saw there. So this is another home that was undergoing renovation and extension. Narayanagar, like all the villages in the Kutch region affected by the earthquake, was built by an NGO group, in this case BAPS. Immediately after the earthquake, the Gujarat government was entirely overwhelmed and unable to administer vital aid to those affected in the multiple sectors of the Kutch district. As a result, the government installed an adoption scheme that called for NGO groups to select specific villages to rebuild according to fiscal capabilities. The people of that village then had to approve of the adoption by this NGO. Finally, the government would consummate this partnership. According to this partnership, the government would initially survey the damage suffered by a town. Inhabitants of the town would be placed in a particular category according to how much damage had been sustained. For example, if you're a family and your entire home was destroyed and basically your house was entirely broken down, you would be placed in a category called G5. And so there's five scales. G1 basically meant you had minor cracks in the structure of your home. G2 was 10% damage. G3 is up to 25%, G4 is up to 50% damage, and then G5 was total destruction. Based upon these figures, the NGO would know the exact minimum housing and property lot specifications required during the rebuilding process. During the actual rebuilding process, the NGO is expected to cover half of the total cost, while the government would cover the other half. Initially, the government had also decreed that in any situation requiring new land to be provided by the government, prospective inhabitants would have to relinquish ownership of all property and land destroyed in their previous residence. Subsequently, however, the government declared that in the situation that the village inhabitants or the sponsor NGO bought the land outright, it would not seize old property. One major emphasis that the government placed on this NGO village adoption scheme was to build new villages that would adequately satisfy the needs of the prospective inhabitants. Thus, NGOs were actively encouraged to consult village leaders on how houses should be clustered in place, what features homes should have, and what types of community features should be offered. Some scholars have alleged that the process of NGO groups requiring Gujarat government approval, which was then under the control of the BJP, led to the pushing of a particular Hindu nationalist ideology. Specifically, Edward Simpson, professor at SOAS, in his book chapter titled Hindutva as a Rural Planning Paradigm, alleges that certain geospatial mappings of reconstructed villages coincide with BJP's vision of a glorious past founded on elitist and charismatic notions of selective Hindu traditions. Simpson goes on to outline three case studies of reconstructed villages that seem predicated upon Hindutva ideologies. One of these is a village of Narayanagar, built by BAPS. Simpson goes on to describe BAPS as a group which, I quote, capitalized on the disaster and have attracted new devotees and lured followers of other sects. For the sake of brevity, I will summarize two specific claims made by Simpson that are meant to expose BAPS's relief efforts as nationalistic in sentiment. First, Simpson claims that BAPS showed significant favor to the majority Patel population in Jaipur, granting them the largest houses in Narayanagar and relegating Muslims and Harijan families to smaller dwellings separated by a road on the outskirts of town. And this is the road that he's actually talking about. I'll talk about it in just a little bit. Second, Simpson purports that the true reason for BAPS building Narayanagar, as well as a number of other villages, was to gain converts to Swaminarayan Hinduism, thereby recreating the countryside in their own image. For BAPS to accomplish this objective, Simpson mentions that a 10,000-book library in the middle of Narayanagar is meant to teach village inhabitants about the Swaminarayan tradition. I'll address that as well. These rather puzzling accusations piqued my own interest in ascertaining the events and narratives that developed after the Kutch earthquake. And so I took a few days off from Sanskrit study in India last year to visit Jiyappan and Narayanagar in January. During my 3 days of research in Narayanagar, I interviewed a total of 18 people that covered both men and women from different religious faiths, including Hindu, and this is mainly made up of Sanatan Hindus, which are Lakshmi Narayan, Ismaili Sufism, and this is made up of a group known as the Satpanthi group, which are mainly Hindu converts, and Muslims, as well as a number of different classes. The main intent for conducting interviews was to discern in detail from the inhabitants the process of selecting BAPS as a sponsor NGO and the ensuing experiences that people had with BAPS during the reconstruction phase. Just as importantly, I wanted to know whether these people were satisfied with the work BAPS had done and whether Simpson's claims had any basis to them. I strategically chose to interview first Naveen Chopra, who is actually the vice president of the leadership committee in Jiyappan during the earthquake, and he's also a current resident of Narayanagar. I showed you earlier that plaque in front of somebody's house. That was actually in front of his own house. And I did this to get an initial holistic conceptualization of the entire rebuilding process. Essentially, I thought this guy, because he was on the planning committee, would know best about what had happened. In response to why the citizens of Jiyappan eventually chose to take aid from BAPS, he replied with the following, and I quote, "At that time, and as we were Lakshmi Narayan, nobody in the town was familiar with BAPS. Every day we went to Bhuj, which I mentioned to you was about less than an hour away from Jiyappan, and saw that BAPS was feeding thousands of people. Thus it became fit in our mind that BAPS will do good work. Even if they do a little less, we can trust in their work. Other companies were offering large homes and pens for our animals, but we decided on BAPS. Today we feel that we made the correct decision because nobody is lacking." As I pushed him for more details in our interview, he revealed that not everyone in the town was as enthusiastic in choosing BAPS as the members of the leadership committee were. The sole voice of opposition came from leaders of the Satpanthi group who attended the Pirana Mandir in Jiyappan. The central dissenting figure from this Satpanthi group was actually their president, Vashram Patad, another person that I did get to interview, who was unwilling to move to Narayanagar if a new mandir for the Satpanthi group was not built. Because of this, before this, Mr. Patan, he had initially gone to meet BAPS officials to inquire whether they would build a new mandir for their group. He was told that due to the limitation of funds, BAPS would be unable to build a separate religious edifice for the multiple religious groups that lived in Jiyappan. This would have entailed building, at the very least, one mosque and two different mandirs. Upon hearing this, Mr. Patan rejected all support from BAPS and turned to assistance provided by the government instead. Using both his sizable monetary means and government subsidies, he was able to reconstruct his home in the damaged Pirana Mandir. Perhaps another factor that ultimately drove Mr. Patad to his decision was an existing quarrel between the followers of the Lakshmi Narayan group and the Satpanthi group within Jiyappan itself. Mr. Chopra, when I was interviewing him, he told us that the Lakshmi Narayan group, they had decided to follow Hindu matrimonial and death rituals, and they had requested everyone else in the village to do so as well. But the Satpanthi group wouldn't agree to do it, and even to today, they refuse to take part in these rituals. In addition to an internal dispute within the village, it is important not to allay the confusion that villagers had over constantly changing government policies. As mentioned before, originally the state government had decreed that building housing on new land would require the government to seize the old land and property of village inhabitants. This proposition led Mr. Patad to widely advise inhabitants of Jiyappan to refuse aid from BAPS, as it would lead, potentially, to old property being seized by the government. Unbeknownst to him, and this was verified when I actually interviewed him, he still didn't know that the rule had changed, the government later made an exception for those villagers or NGO groups that bought the land outright for construction. During the rebuilding process, the Jiyappan Leadership Committee had actually gone to meet the spiritual head of BAPS, Pramukh Swami Maharaj, in Mumbai to discuss securing a loan. Essentially, they wanted to take out a loan to buy the new land so that they wouldn't lose their old land and their possessions. Mr. Chopra, he detailed what happened in that meeting, and this is a quote. Immediately, Pramukh Swami Maharaj told us there was no need to take out a loan and that BAPS would cover the entire cost of all the new land. Overall, the Narayanagar land cost around 3.2 crore rupees. The elders of the village broke down in tears at the generosity and openness of BAPS. After this event, everyone in the village was amazed and taken back by this gesture. The town people backed BAPS in return. Mr. Patad, likely because he chose to reject BAPS support, remained unaware of what had actually happened. In fact, every single villager that I interviewed in both Jiapur and Narayanagar openly pointed out that Mr. Patad attempted to use his own influence as a community leader to persuade others to reject aid from BAPS. Because of these attempts, most of the Satbandhi group actually remained in Jiapur, and they still reside there today, but there are a number of them that have moved to Narayanagar. Others, however, convinced that BAPS would neither allow villagers to lose old property or force inhabitants of Narayanagar to convert to Swaminarayan faith, chose to move into Narayanagar. Today, none of the 16 interviewees residing in Narayanagar regret leaving Jiapur. Perhaps more importantly for academics, particularly Professor Simpson, is that there has been absolutely minimal conversion to the Swaminarayan faith by inhabitants of Narayanagar. Despite a Swaminarayan Mandir being the only religious site in Narayanagar, Hindus, Muslims, and Satbandhis alike come to the temple and see it as a space that is inviting and important for community cohesion. So whenever there's festivals such as Diwali, every single inhabitant, regardless of religious affiliation, is invited to the temple, and many of them do attend. During the interviews, I also interviewed quite a few Muslim women as well as lower class women, and they mentioned that even if they couldn't make it to the celebrations at the temple, thereafter the prasad that was came out as a result of the festival would be distributed to every single household in Narayanagar itself. These inhabitants, while also attending this temple in Narayanagar, also attend their respective places of worship back in Jiapur. The road of separation, which is pictured here, that Simpson was talking about, as he mentions it as a divisive factor in Narayanagar that separates the Muslims and lower-class Hindus from the elite Hindus, as he calls them. But during my interviews, I found out that BAPS worked very closely. The engineers and village planners, they worked very closely with the committee, leadership committee, as well as inhabitants, prospective inhabitants as well. And during this process, and this was verified during the interviews, inhabitants said that back in Jiapur, they had been clustered in the very same way that they're clustered today in Narayanagar. And not only that, but today they're actually closer to their family members, whereas in Jiapur, because it's such an old town, if a new inhabitant wanted to come, he would likely have to live quite far from his own family. And so when Narayanagar was constructed, they ordered it in such a way that family members would be clustered together. And so because of my interviews and my research there, there certainly does not seem to be the anti-Muslim and pro-elitist Hindu model that Simpson is advocating. And perhaps most surprisingly, there is no 10,000 book library to advocate such a brand of Swaminarayan Hinduism. There's not a single library in all of Narayanagar, which really brings quite a bit of doubt about the research that Simpson did. To conclude, I think it's very important to consider dynamics on the ground. And such as in this case, there's inter-village disputes, there's evolving governmental policies, and there's power structures that you may not be able to glean through superficial analysis. Without understanding these dynamics, one is susceptible to the danger of superficial and inaccurate analyses. This research is meant to serve as a reminder for the necessity to exercise caution in academic studies. At times, new topics of interest can draw the attention of multiple scholars. I remember, for example, in 2000, many scholars of Hindu studies were only interested in talking about who had the authority to speak for Hinduism. If you looked at all the AAR journals, a number of journals, that's all the articles were talking about, who speaks for Hinduism. And now, as well as in the past, Hindu nationalism draws considerable attention. This alone, however, should not constrict or direct subsequent research. Objectivity, novelty, and transparency in research is more important. Moreover, at a much larger level, scholarship that is inaccurate can severely damage the reputation of those undeserving of such criticism. In this case, it could very well discourage other Hindu NGOs from engaging in work out of fear of being targeted by unfounded accusations. This, at a time where religious NGOs are extremely vital to the well-being of India's population, would mean repercussions well outside the scholarly sphere. Thank you.